This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
When your adult child is severely mentally ill and addicted, you get two choices in America. You can let them go back to the streets, back to the shelters, back to the slow motion suicide of homelessness, or you can keep them close in your guest house, in your spare room, in your life, and hope every single day that they don't hurt themselves or you. Rob and Michelle Reiner chose the second option. It killed them. But here's the part nobody wants to say out loud. What else were they supposed to do? Nick Reiner is facing two counts of first-degree murder. His defense attorney is building an insanity defense. And the public conversation has mostly split into two camps, people who blame Nick entirely and people who want to blame the mental health system. But the truth is uglier than either of those narratives. The truth is that Rob and Michelle Reiner were trapped legally, financially, emotionally trapped. And the system that was supposed to help them offered nothing but a series of impossible choices. This is a very deep, very large problem where there's issues here, here, over there, and back here, and that way too. We're going to get into all of this. Before we do, let me ask you this. Please press subscribe wherever it is you are listening to us or watching us. YouTube, podcast channels, whatever it may be, please do hit that. It helps us, lets other folks know you like our reporting, and then you get all of our stories as we put them out to you. And if you want to comment, there's two options for you. YouTube, you can certainly do it there. We're also on Substack now as well, hiddenkillers.substack.com, or just search Hidden Killers on Substack and you will find us. You can also access our episodes a day early. So if you want tomorrow's videos today, go and check out our Substack. And it also helps support our program as well. There's opportunities to subscribe and help support our reporting. So thank you for that. Let's continue on. So let me go into this and how this all works. Because if you haven't lived it, you probably don't understand how broken our system really is. And a lot of people, this has been a wake-up call. It's been a, oh my God, really? It's this horrible? Yes, it is. Thank your lucky stars you haven't had to deal with this system in any way, shape, or form. If you were that far out of the woods and didn't know what was going on in the forest, you can be forgiven if you didn't know. But now that you do know, now it's up to you to, well, let your voice be heard, because it's broken. In California, involuntary commitment is governed by something called the Lanterman-Petras Short Act. It was passed in 1967, and it was signed by Ronald Reagan. The intent, initially, okay, kind of noble, end the abuses of the old asylum system. Remember these stories? And some were very true. And some asylums, as we had them, and I know this for a fact. I've done many research projects on this, actually, for another podcast that we do about ghost stories. There were some that were very well-kept. They were respectable. They treated their patients well. There were some that were literally the 13th gate to hell. And then there was everything in between. It needed reform. It didn't necessarily need to be completely destroyed and abandoned. Because when you completely destroy and abandon whatever kind of rails you have on a system that is designed to try and keep the padding, although sometimes it looked more like spikes, around people who could be dangerous to themselves or others, and of course there were some that weren't at all, but a lot of them were. When you just suddenly remove all of that and say, good luck, things don't end well. And in the United States, they did not end well. And we are still seeing the repercussions of that to this day. So the intent was to end the abuses of the asylum system. That was the intent, where people could be locked away indefinitely because a family member wanted them gone. That was horrible. Civil rights protections came into place, due process, all good things, okay? But anything can go too far as well. And here's what this law means in practice for families dealing with severe mental illness. You cannot force your adult child into treatment unless they are an imminent danger to themselves or others. They're gravely disabled, meaning they literally cannot provide food, clothing, or shelter for themselves. Keyword is imminent. So someone could be literally sitting there saying, I'm going to blow my head off here. And you call 911. This is in California. And then they get there like, oh no, I was just kidding. It was a joke. They misunderstood. You can't by law do anything about that. You can't take them in if they're going to back out of that. Yeah, it's dangerous. It's extremely dangerous, especially for people who know how to use the system. And look, mental illness does not prevent you from being a cunning individual. In many ways, it's kind of becomes a superpower. So that word imminent, not probably dangerous, not getting worse, not everyone can see this is heading somewhere terrible, imminent. And as of right now, this second, about to happen. If your adult child is psychotic, but technically feeding themselves, you can't commit them. If they're making threats but haven't acted yet, you can't commit them. If they've been violent in the past but aren't being violent at this exact moment, you can't commit them. The law requires you to wait until the crisis is already happening, and by then it's often too late. You're basically saying they have to be kind of in a catatonic state to admit them. Families get one tool. The 5150 hold, 72 hours. Yeah, 72 hours to sanity, right? Should be a reality show. In 72 hours, every single thing that they've been suffering with their mental illness has been gone and vanished, and they're ready to live their lives the way they've always wanted to. No, of course, that's utterly insane. 72 hours will do it. That's it. A police officer or a clinician can place someone into a 5150 if they meet the criteria. The person goes into a psychiatric facility for evaluation treatment 3 days. And then sometimes they don't even make it the 3 days. Sometimes if the facility says, we think they're good after 24, bye-bye, we need that bed. Then what? Let's say you get the 3 days. If the patient says the right things. The addicts are very good at saying the right things. You do realize this, right? They get released, even if the family begs the facility to keep them longer. Even if everyone in the room knows the person is going to walk out and start using again, the patient says, right, the patient can refuse treatment, and the patient walks out the door. Nick Reiner had reportedly been through 17 rehab programs by the time he was 22. Some other numbers being reported go higher than that. That means 17 times the system evaluated him. 17 times it determined he was ready to leave. 17 times it spit him back out into the world because Nick knew how to play the game. He admitted it himself. On the Dopey podcast, staying sober just long enough to satisfy the counselors, then going right back to using the moment he was free. The system wasn't designed for people like Nick. It's designed for people who want help. And when someone doesn't want help, when they actively resist it, manipulate it, game it, which is most of the people who go into that system, at least the first round or 10, the system has nothing to offer except a revolving door. So what options did Rob and Michelle actually have? Well, option one, kick him out. Kick Nick out. Let him go. Tell him he's on his own. Watch him disappear into the homeless encampments of Los Angeles. Wait for the phone call that he overdosed under a freeway overpass or froze to death in an alley or got killed in a fight over nothing. This is what the system essentially recommends when treatment isn't working. You can't force him. He has to want it. You need to set boundaries. True, you do. Translation, let your child die and learn to live with it. Or maybe they'll make it through, but you have to take that gamble. And some parents do this. They have to. I'm not saying it is wrong at all. Sometimes you have to do this. Otherwise, they will continue to go down the path they're going down and you get a Nick Reiner situation. We are pointing out here too, here's your options. What's missing from this equation? That option that actually used to exist, was abused, was not managed properly, was, yeah, needs a lot of reform, a lot of help. But there was a third option at one time, another place people could get people that truly did need help for their own safety and the safety of others. But we do not have that anymore. So back to today. For their own survival, for the safety of the other children, they can cut ties. And then they spend the rest of their lives wondering if tonight is the night that they get the call. Option two, hope for an arrest. Sounds insane, but it is real. Some families actually pray their mentally ill child gets arrested, and that, good. For drugs, for theft, for assault, for anything. Because jail is sometimes the only institution that will hold them long enough to stabilize, to get clean. The criminal justice system becomes the de facto mental health system. That's where we are. Parents hoping their kids get locked up because the treatment systems won't. Or option three, become an institution yourself. Keep them close, house them, feed them, monitor them around the clock, try to manage their medication, their moods, their episodes. Hope you can hold things together until what? Until they magically get better? Until some breakthrough happens that 17 rehab programs couldn't achieve? This is what Rob and Michelle did. They reportedly kept Nick in the guest house under watchful supervision, except they weren't psychiatrists. They weren't nurses. They weren't trained in crisis intervention or de-escalation. They were a 78-year-old man and a 70-year-old woman trying to manage someone who, according to sources, had schizophrenia and active addiction. A neighbor told the New York Post that Nick had been violent before. An LAPD insider said, there have been quite a few calls for service at the Reiner home over the years. Rob reportedly told friends the night before his death, I'm petrified of Nick. I think my own son can hurt me. He knew. There was nothing he could legally do about it. There is option four, fight for an LPS conservatorship. This is the long-term involuntary commitment option in California. The problem, the bar is extraordinarily high. Gravely disabled doesn't mean clearly deteriorating or obviously dangerous. It means the person literally cannot provide for their own basic needs, and even then the family can't petition for it directly. It has to come from a public guardian's office after the person has already been through the hold process. Even when granted, it has to be renewed every single year. Every year you have to go back to court and fight to keep your adult child in care. According to county officials, conservatorships are granted only in the most extreme cases. Board and care placements are scarce. Funding is inadequate. One public health official described it as a 50-year-old problem that has just gotten worse every year. The system doesn't have the capacity even when it has the will. And here's the part that might surprise people. Money doesn't fix this. The Reiners, they had money. They were reportedly paying $70,000 a month for treatment facilities. They had access to the best doctors, the best programs, the best everything. It didn't matter because you can't buy your way out of a legal system that prioritizes patient autonomy over family safety. You can pay for the nicest rehab in California and your adult child can still walk out after 72 hours if you say or if they say the right words. Now imagine you don't have money. Imagine you're, you know, a normal person, a working class family with a schizophrenic son and a $50,000 household income. Public mental health services are overwhelmed. Wait lists stretch for months. doesn't exactly translate into immediate help that's needed when there's a mental health emergency. Oh, let me get back to you in a couple months. Community placements are vanishing for families without resources. The options aren't limited. They're non-existent. Governor Newsom promised to fix this. His Care Court program launched in 2022. It went statewide. By December of 24, family members could petition a judge to order treatment housing services, a care plan. Families were hopeful that finally someone was listening. But according to recent reporting from Cal Matters, many of the same families now say Care Court has fallen short. Lovely. It sounds great on paper. And then, oh, yeah. Loved ones dropped from the program for failing to participate in voluntary treatment. The same cycle of jail and homelessness continuing. One mother called it a false hope. The system promised change and delivered paperwork. So let's talk about what Rob and Michelle Reiner reportedly lived with every single day. Because according to multiple reports, they brought Nick to a Christmas party because they were afraid to leave him home alone. They watched him act erratically, reportedly asking guests if they were famous, interrupting private conversations, staring at people until they were uncomfortable. They got into a loud argument in front of everyone. They left early, humiliated and scared. They went home and wondered if that night was the night something would happen. They woke up the next morning, or they didn't. This is what millions of families live with right now. The constant calculus of risk, the exhaustion of vigilance, the knowledge that the person you love could also be the person who destroys you. Rob knew. He reportedly said it out loud at that party. I'm petrified of Nick. I think my own son can hurt me. He was right. And the system gave him no way out. Now, let me be absolutely clear about something. None of this excuses Nick Reiner. Nick chose to game rehab by his own admission. Nick chose to manipulate his parents into distrusting the experts. Nick chose to keep using despite 17 opportunities to get clean. Nick allegedly chose to walk into his parents' bedroom in the early morning hours of December 14th and stab them to death. The impossible situation Rob and Michelle faced, Nick created it. He convinced them the programs didn't work. He convinced them to trust him over the professionals. He engineered the arrangement that put him in that guest house instead of a supervised facility. This is not about letting Nick off the hook. It's about recognizing that his parents were trapped in a system like many, 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 many others are, that offered them no real help, and that millions of dollars and millions of other families are trapped right now in exactly the same way with no rescue coming. The mental health system failed Rob and Michelle Reiner, but Nick failed them first and longer and more deliberately. The system's failure doesn't erase his accountability. It just means there were two failures instead of one. Right now, tonight, somewhere in California, there are parents lying awake, listening for footsteps, wondering if their child is stable, wondering if the medication is working, and wondering if this is the night everything falls apart. They can't commit their children. They can't force treatment. They can't protect themselves without abandoning someone they love. The legal system tells them their adult child has rights. The treatment system cycles their kid through 72-hour holds and calls it care. The mental health system tells them to set boundaries and practice self-care as if a scented candle is going to stop a psychotic episode. And when something terrible happens, when a parent ends up dead, when a family is destroyed, we act shocked. We ask, how could this have happened? We demand answers. It happens because we built a system that protects the autonomy of people who cannot safely exercise it and abandons the families trying to keep them alive. It happens because we've decided that civil liberties matter more than civil safety, even when the person with the liberties is a danger to everyone around them. It happens because we've made it nearly impossible to help people who don't want help. And then we blame the families when the inevitable occurs. Rob and Michelle Reiner are dead. Nick Reiner is in a cell at Twin Towers wearing a suicide smock. And somewhere tonight, another family is facing the same impossible choice they faced. Let him go or watch him die slowly or keep him close to you and hope he doesn't kill you. That's not a mental health system. That's a coin flip with your life. And guess what? The house always wins. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on our Substack channel, hiddenkillers.substack.com, or just search Hidden Killers there. Or on YouTube, if you're there, do comment. We'd love to get your thoughts on this case. We read the comments in both places. If you want tomorrow's videos today, be sure to check out that Substack channel and be sure to press subscribe. Wherever you're listening to us, wherever you're watching us, please hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any of our reporting. And if you really like it, use Apple Podcasts, a review there, always very much appreciated on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for your support of this program. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Let's go over to the Reiner case. Nick Reiner is set to be arraigned tomorrow on two counts of first-degree murder, Wednesday, that is, with special circumstances in the stabbing deaths of his parents. Legendary filmmaker Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle Singer Reiner, the 32-year-old, has been held without bail at Twin Towers Correctional Facility since his arrest December 14th, the same day his parents' bodies were discovered in the master bedroom of their Brentwood home. Defense attorney Alan Jackson, obviously known for his work with Karen Reed and Harvey Weinstein, has been signaling from day one that mental health will be a central key component to this case. He's called it a devastating tragedy with very complex and serious issues as he cashes his check. Sources have confirmed Nick was diagnosed with schizophrenia years ago and his medication was changed in the weeks prior to the killings. A sealed medical order has already been signed by the judge overseeing the case. All signs point to the insanity defense, but what does that actually mean in California, and how hard is it to win, and what is Alan Jackson really building here other than his bank account? To break it down, Bob Mata is with this. Bob, Allen has been using those phrases, complex, serious issues, asking for restraint and dignity since the first appearance outside the courthouse to you. What is he telegraphing, and how early does a defense attorney typically start laying groundwork for the insanity defense?
Pretty early. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you look at the situation for what it is, and I think everybody that was kind of looking at that from the outside, looking in, was like, it was either the addiction or it was mental illness or a combination of both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's like, so yeah, I mean, typically if you know as the attorney, kind of the way that this thing played out, you were lining up your doctors immediately. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of putting it out there. And if you are of the mindset, because we really do as defense attorneys consider it to be the defense of last resort, because it is such a hard sell.
Yeah.
It is so hard to get a jury to utter the words, not guilty by reason of insanity. It's like, it's really hard for them to say those words because it feels like you're giving that person a pass. And that's just not the society we live in, mm-hmm. you know, and people that, and we talk about this a lot, T, on like a lot of these cases that you and I talk about, we talk about the aspect of people that don't have firsthand experience with somebody with mental illness mm-hmm. just tend to think that it's not a real thing.
Yeah.
Like that it doesn't exist in the way that it does actually exist for these folks that suffer from mental illnesses of varying varieties. And mm-hmm. It's such a tough sell. I mean, it really boils down to, do you have doctors on the stand that are going to be able to make it vivid and real for the jurors so that they understand, well, holy shit, this is something that actually exists mm-hmm. in the world. And you know, I think I told the story about the, you know, the friend that we had in law school who was a paranoid schizophrenic, and she was mm-hmm. under meds, and they have meds that don't cure that, but they certainly are able to tamp it down. And I mean, they're very effective medications, and they don't have all of the symptoms that they typically would have if they don't. The problem with a lot of the medication is that when you have people that are on these meds for a long time, it makes you feel a kind of a way, that's not mm-hmm. the way that you normally feel. And it's not a way that they like feeling. So what they tend to think is, oh, I'm better. Yeah. Like, I'm not, like, this shit's not happening with me. Like, I don't feel like there's somebody constantly chasing me who wants to murder me, and which is vividly real for them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Vividly. There's no part. There is no like, oh, it's just my mental illness. like, of course there's nobody chasing me. That thought never enters their mind. Everything mm-hmm. that a paranoid schizophrenic feels is real as the three of us sitting on here doing this YouTube presentation today. It's vividly real. There is no telling them that it's not. Like, cause I like my, I had a family member that he wasn't necessarily a paranoid schizophrenic, but he had schizophrenia. He had paranoid delusions. And no matter what I said to him, and I'm a very like open book, I'm not afraid to like dig into the shit with people, And sure. It's like, I would sit there and I tell him, I'm like, look, man, it's like, I know that you're having a hard time believing me, because it got to the point where he didn't trust us mm-hmm. and we were family, And I was like, look, I'm just telling you that like none of what you think is happening. And I know for you that you think that it really is. It isn't. And I know that there's no way that I'm going to be able to encourage you to believe what I'm saying in a way that it's going to resonate in your mind. So like ultimately, he ended up going and getting treatment, and they put him on so much lithium that this guy was like a shell of what yeah. he used to be. He was walking around like, he had no affect.
Yeah.
And he was like not a human being almost. He was just kind of like a pod walking around that could move, but didn't have any kind of thoughts. He just didn't, his personality was completely gone. So you want to lay the groundwork. If you're an attorney, that it's going to be an insanity or a mental defect case as early as possible, to kind of start the dialogue. Like, that's the one thing I always want to happen. I want the dialogue about mental illness to mm-hmm. start happening in this country. And we've like dug in, you and I have
yeah.
about this, that they're what do we do with these folks? There's nowhere to yeah. put them. What do no. families do? When they're dealing with a family member that's going through this shit. And I know you've written some powerful shit on this case in particular about that exact issue. What was Rob Reiner supposed to do?
Yeah.
Beyond what he had already done.
Because that's the reality.
Our comment section has completely blown up. Every time we do a Reiner story, there are people in there who are talking about their experiences. This is not a one-off. This is not some weird anomaly in the community. People are dealing with this 24/7 in our communities.
Yeah. And if there's anything in this, and I said this, I think, on the first piece I did on this case, is that let's use this to learn from mm-hmm. and to raise awareness of what millions of families are dealing yes. with across the country. Because it's not a rich people problem. It's not a poor people problem. It's not it's an everybody problem. When there's addiction and mental illness, which strikes everybody, it doesn't matter what, this is the reality of the world that we live in. If you are the caregiver or someone who loves and cares about somebody that is afflicted with addiction and mental illness, or one or the other, or both, or vice versa, or whatever, you have a few options. You can either basically become their full-time caregiver and become your own at-home, inpatient facility, which no one is equipped to do or qualified to do unless you are actually a doctor. And even then, that's not something to take home with you. Number two, you can let them go die on the streets.
Yeah.
And hope for the best that maybe they'll get their shit together and things will change, or something will happen, or they'll get locked up and get clean that way, or whatever. The third option, which used to exist, was the involuntarily permanent type hold where we used to have mental health facilities that existed. Reagan got rid of those in the 80s. They don't exist anymore because of abuse, because people were like, that bitch is crazy. And then they go lock up their wife or right. their husband or their kids or whatever. And then it was horrible.
Right.
Now, to say that we couldn't go back and revisit that and say, hey, let's do this ethically. Let's yeah, do this correctly. Right. But we don't. We're just like, that didn't work all those years ago. Yeah, there's a lot of things that didn't work years ago, but we decided to improve upon it and make it actually functional, but we don't because it costs money. So yeah. what do? Our mental health facilities for folks like this, it now consists of being under the overpass on I-95.
That's right. The street.
And that's basically the, and then we're like, why are all these homeless people here? Let's build more houses. No, let's get them help. Because
right.
you can build all the houses you want in the world. They'll trash them. They'll destroy them. They'll kill people in them. They'll kill themselves in them. They'll destroy the neighborhoods that they go into. Fix the problem. It's the mental health. It's the addiction. But we don't want to do that because that's a little bit too difficult to handle. And that's the reality. No matter how much money you have, Michelle and Nick yeah. and Rob Reiner had all the cash in the fucking yeah. world.
Money
and it
wasn't
didn't
the problem.
Fix the problem.
Right.
So that yeah. is the reality that so many families are dealing with on this. I've gotten so many letters from so many people on this and so many comments. I'm working out an interview right now with an individual, a fairly famous individual, whose story has been covered on TMZ and others, whose son she survived this, and she wants to tell her story. And that may be coming to the program here shortly to share her story within the Hollywood that. Circle of folks.
So
I'll tell you about it off the air.
Dialogues, dude.
Yeah.
And
because it's happening and there's just no recourse for people other than you risk becoming Robin Michelle Reiner, mm-hmm. you know, or your kid dying. And those are the choices.
Not only is it happening, I think it's more prevalent right now than it ever has.
Yes.
Been.
Yeah.
Okay,
like,
mental illness is not getting better. Like these fucking things, dude, like all the shit that we're ingesting in terms of poisons that they're putting in the food that we eat, in terms of us walking through, like if we were able to see the amount of invisible waves that we walk through in our brain is like,
look in our house.
It's insane.
I have a coffee machine that is hooked to Wi-Fi. Every time I make a cup of coffee, my phone alerts me that coffee's being made. No shit, Sherlock. I hit the button.
When this thing's getting hot, it's radiation. Like, that's not a secret. Like, we're fucking with our brains in ways that we were never even capable of fucking with prior to.
And the drugs that are available to people are turning people quite literally into zombies. I mean, if you want an example of it, go on Instagram. This one came up the other day. It's absolutely horrible to laugh at because it is so sad and disturbing. On a horrible level, you may look at it and go, oh my God, the irony is priceless here. Look up Tweaker Geographic on Instagram. And you will find many of videos. This is somebody that's videotaping basically zombie like tweakers in various cities. And then they narrate it like National Geographic.
I've seen it. It's fucked up.
It's horrible, but it's real. And that's what's so scary, but because it's like Night of the Living Dead. It's The Walking Dead. And these people are everywhere. And these are people that at one time had people that loved them, that cared about them. They have families that
people that love them.
They probably still do.
Them,
yeah.
But they can't deal with them.
Exactly. Because you can't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, dude. And those folks are probably self-medicating.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like
they have something else
going on. Right. So it's like they've gotten to that point. That's why I'm saying that there is, I'm not going to throw a statistic on it because I don't know the statistics, but I would not be shocked to think that 80% of heavy drug users are also suffering from some kind of mental illness. And it's them trying to self-medicate because they haven't gone and gotten help, or they don't realize that they need help.
They're trying to quell the monster within because nothing else has fucking worked. And excuse my language, I don't normally drop the bombs here, but I know you do. But my brother was the same. There was something in his past that he never talked about. I have suspicions, But he started down the path of drug use because nothing was working. The voices in his head were too loud. Yes. Nothing was working. So he decided to take matters into his own hands. And he did. And now he's one of the walking zombies. Guaranteed. Yeah. I'm waiting for the phone call anytime now that he's dead.
Seriously. It's fucking heartbreaking. Yep. You know, it really is. Yep. Hey, Stace, throw up 1140 because this, like Brian's comment, is like one of the most profound, like six word sentences that you'll ever read. And it's so true. It's where she says, we don't blame people. No, 1140 go down. We don't blame people with dementia. And
I saw that.
When you think about that, that is the perfect way to try to have people understand. Because dementia, a lot of us have somebody that is suffering from dementia, somebody that we love. And as you watch it progress, and as you watch every memory of that person slip away into the night to the point where they don't remember you, the person that you're closest to in terms of them, it becomes real. It's like, Brian, that was such a great thing to put out there because it's a way that people will start to understand that mental health issues and mental illness is real. You know, because I'm telling you, man, like this case, it is like moving mountains. When there's a homicide at the other side of this thing and you're in a court of law and you're trying to convince 12 people that this person did not have control over their mind, they could not form the requisite intent to commit this crime. And people are like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like he went to a convenience store right afterwards and bought chips. He's fucking normal. What are you talking?
No, he's not.
He hid the gun. I'm like, dude. No,
he's not. But the thing is, he made so many choices when he was sober and in a better state that and he openly talked about it on the Dopey podcast and many other places where he chose the wrong path because it's what he wanted to do, what was better when he wasn't necessarily under the influence. So, of course, we know that this exists, you know, the mental illness exists. But I think the big question is whether we're going to allow it to be an excuse again. For it's been an excuse his whole life for all of his behavior. Oh, Nick's this, no, Nick's that. We got to bring our 32-year-old to the Christmas party because we can't trust him at home because he's an addict because of this. And now we killed them. So are we going to allow this to be another excuse again? Or are we going to finally say, you know what? Yeah, we know this exists. You yourself knew it existed, Nick, and you continued to make horrible choices. And those horrible choices put you into a situation where you lost your autonomy and you lost your control and you did horrible things. But those choices that you made led you to that place.
We're going to let this happen. I absolutely think that's exactly what's going to happen. He's just going to be another one that ends up in prison. Throw him away for life. Next.
And you know what?
One?
Good. Put him up because rehab hasn't worked.
Locking him aspect out of it, though.
Maybe locking him away years ago to get him sober might have been the actual solution because the rehabs didn't work. It led him to more drugs, actually. If he had been in a facility like a prison, and I know prisons aren't necessarily rehab, you know, or correctional, even though it's in the title, it forces you to be sober in a lot of ways. Yeah, you can get drugs in prison, but your odds are a lot slimmer than on the streets. Maybe that would have been a solution here at some point in time, rather than every single time putting up more padded walls.
But what is the impact of that moving forward for the rest of the world?
Well, exactly. Is it the solution? No. But is it better than what we have right now? Might have in this case it done something? Maybe.
Is it not a solution? It's not a deterrent either.
No.
Like nobody that's fucking mentally ill is going to say, oh, well, fucking.
There's no deterrent for that.
Well, so here's my thing, man. Forget it, the addiction thing's one part of it, okay? And the addiction and the mental illness are two separate components completely, okay? Mm-hmm. So here's where I think his culpability may lie. If he, in fact, was diagnosed by a competent psychotherapist or psychologist or whoever he was seeing, and they said, okay, we have diagnosed you with it. We have run it through our board. We all agree. Because that's how they do that. When you go and get – and like you said, this guy had access to all the money in the world. So presumably he's going to very good doctors. Mm-hmm. And once they diagnosed him, I don't know the time frame of that. But right. to me, where the culpability lies is if, like, we'll say 3 years ago, he's diagnosed with schizophrenia and mm-hmm. it's fucking raging. Okay. And they're like, okay, we've got meds that are going to control this disease. Okay. And if he chose to get off of his meds, knowing that they helped when he was on them, then there's a question for me of culpability. Then, because mm-hmm. it was a known thing, it was being treated, and he knowingly and voluntarily quit taking his meds because he didn't like the way they made him feel.
But that's what they do. You talked about it. So how do you work through that? Because that's exactly what they do. They think they're better. Yeah.
I know. It's a conundrum. But, in terms of, like, I can't get to where T is with it. You know, it's like, I don't give a fuck who his parents were. I'm looking at it just as like, you know, yeah, Hollywood fucking royalty has been murdered here and it's tragic. Sure. And they had all the resources in the world. I'm forgetting about all that. I'm going to strip it down to kind of the base of what the issue is here, because for us as lawyers, you're always trying to compare it to other cases and see how it's going to affect the law moving forward. And, you know, in this particular case, they're going to be able to put on evidence that he was schizophrenic. Okay.
So without a doubt,
from that point forward, the state is going to be saying, okay, you're right. We concede that portion. Okay. He was diagnosed. He was also given medication that is known to be effective. And at some point he made the decision to get off of it. So that, and I get what you're saying, Stace, but that is going to be the legality question of it. If they are aware of it, if they voluntarily get off their meds.
I don't know how you do you prove that?
Well, they quit taking it. He doesn't re-up his scripts. I mean, there'll be a paper trail. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Unless he's re-upping his scripts and he's just flushing them.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.